Welcome. In today's podcast, I'll be talking about developing a web presence by securing a domain name, uploading a website, and creating engaging content. The last podcast in the web series examined the theoretical framework of a web presence. As a reminder, I believe the primary purpose of a church website is to connect potential first-time guests to the congregation. Yes, a website can improve efficiency by posting information that once required the production of a newsletter. Yes, a good website keeps members informed and engaged, but that's secondary to connecting your ministry to new guests and potential members. Your members will put up with a great deal more bad design and functionality in a website than a potential guest will. Also, if you are convinced that you could never get a good website up and running, or you know that you'll never be a good coder, don't worry. I'm going to walk you through the development of a web page using simple-to-follow instructions and tools. If you are a visual learner, or you find that my descriptions are not up to par, you can find a video of this podcast on the district website. In addition, if you send me an email and request a copy, I can send you a step-by-step guide. Just to be sure we're on the same page, I want to give you a quick overview of the process of developing a web presence in 5 steps. Step 1, get your domain name. Step 2, lease server space. Step 3, redirect name servers. Step 4, gather the content. Step 5, upload the content. Now, if that sounds complicated or like it's being spoken in a different language, don't worry. Hopefully by the end of this podcast, those steps will make sense to you and you will see that it's not that difficult. Let's talk about step 1. Getting your domain name. A domain name is the address that people type in their browsers to find your ministry. For example, www.michigandistrict.org is the domain name for the Michigan District. In that example, the 3 W's indicate that the web page is on the World Wide Web. That is, it's not on an internal server. The Michigan District portion of the address is the domain name proper, and the .org is the top-level domain. When the World Wide Web was developed, it was envisioned that .com domains would represent commercial organizations, the .org would represent nonprofit organizations, the .gov, government, and .edu, educational institutions. However, there's no regulation prohibiting a nonprofit from taking on a .com name. While today's users are a bit more savvy than those of even just 5 years ago, it is still considered desirable to register as a .com domain name when it's available and possible. People have grown to assume that an address is a .com address. Also, you will occasionally see a subdomain address. A subdomain address has an additional word and a period or dot in the name. For example, www.members.michigandistrict.org. That domain name is fictitious, but it is an example of a subdomain, members, which is a separate area within the larger domain of michigandistrict.org. How do you get a domain? You have to use a domain registration company to purchase a domain name. There are several companies that work incredibly well. My favorite are Namecheap.com, Name.com, and Hover.com. Now, I have been a long-time user of GoDaddy, but over the years, their control panel has gotten very cluttered, and they push an overabundance of add-on services which are not necessary and can easily turn a $12 purchase into a $90 purchase. Now, that raises a good question. How much does a domain name cost? Keep in mind that you don't actually own the domain name once you've bought it. You're leasing the rights to the name. Therefore, you have to keep renewing the lease. Some people buy 1-year leases, some buy 5-year leases. Also, a .com domain name will be more expensive than a .org domain name. You can really save cash by selecting a .tv, .me, or .cloud domain extension. However, you might scare off potential visitors when they see the off-the-wall domain extension. Generally, you'll spend about $13 per year for a .com and about $9 per year for a .org. You'll often find that the naming companies offer you a significant discount for the first year, only to jack the price up in the second year. This strategy works in their favor because it's not easy to transfer the domain name to another company. Here's how to find and purchase a domain name through Namecheap.com. Once you've navigated to Namecheap.com, you will see that they have a search for your domain name prominently placed, and simply enter in the domain name that you would like to find. So let's say we want to find a domain name for Trinity Brownstown. I'm going to search, and we see that TrinityBrownstown.com is available for $8.88 a year. So we add that to the cart, and then we would simply complete their cart process by selecting view the cart. I'm not going to actually continue purchasing through their purchasing process, but this is typical. You'll see that it gives you the option of how many years you want to purchase a domain for. The longer you purchase it, the longer you lock in that price. So you just select the number of years that you want to have the domain name registered. You'll also notice that there are a number of upcharges that are available. WhoisGuard is a service that protects people from finding your personal information and bugging you with all kinds of advertisements and spam and the like. If it's a personal domain, that's probably a good thing to have. If it's a church domain and it is a staff account registering the domain, then it's not necessary at all because it'll simply show the information to the congregation. It helps people who want to find your church to find who you are. So WhoisGuard is not necessary and could be removed. Now, you'll notice here it's free. In many other domain name providers, it's not free. You'll also see a number of upcharges like adding Gmail to the account, adding security. You can ignore all of these things. You don't need any of them. You just simply need to select this, confirm the order, and then pay for the domain name. So it's pretty simple. What happens if the name was not available? Then you have to find a different name. Some common suggestions regarding selecting a domain name, I find most helpful to use the name of the church and the name of the community. And you'll notice that I didn't choose Trinity Lutheran Brownstown. You could do that. It just makes it longer, and longer names are harder for people to find and to search. But you can do that if you wish. You want to avoid using abbreviations if at all possible, like instead of Holy Trinity, typing htbrownstown.com. People are not going to remember that. It would be better just to have Holy Trinity Brownstown. If you have a town that's difficult to spell the name, then you may not want to use the name of the town. It'll be challenging because congregations' names, there's just a limited pool of popular names for churches. If we were to type in Trinity.com, we could get a variety of churches and probably a variety of businesses that would come up with that name. So it's more difficult if you can't use the town's name. But if it's a difficult town to spell, like I live near Ypsilanti, Michigan. Ypsilanti, for those in Michigan, they're used to spelling it, but for the rest of the world, they can't pronounce it, much less spell it. You may have to come up with a different naming system like Trinity Lutheran or Trinity Lutheran Michigan, coming up with some naming system that will help. You might just end up doing Trinity Ypsilanti. You know, the people that are going to likely be potential members of your church obviously live in the area of Ypsilanti, so they will know how to spell it. But it's just something to be aware of. You still will have some difficulty. You could use a .net or a .org, which is not even shown in the options here until quite far down. But that's also available for your use if you prefer. And that's how easy it is to find the domain name. Once you've purchased the domain name, keep the information, that is the username and password of the account, in a secure location. Treat the information like the deed to your property. It is not uncommon for a layperson or a pastor to register the domain name for the church and keep the information on their personal computer. However, it is almost impossible to get control of the domain name without that account information. Since the name was purchased on behalf of the ministry, that account information needs to be in control of the ministry itself. I've seen churches struggle because the member with login credentials passes away, and churches struggle to be able to manage their website, manage their domain name, because they don't have the account information. I have seen churches struggle when someone with the login credentials became angry at the pastor and posted horrible comments about the pastor and the ministry on the ministry website. Because the site was purchased in the member's name with the member's funds, the church had to take legal action to seize control of the website. It took a long time and a great deal of money before the congregation had control of the website. So the first step is done. You've purchased your domain name. Now the second step, leasing server space. A server is a specialized computer which is designed to render web pages, provide document storage and retrieval, and manage databases. Most churches will just use their server to host their website. The good news is that leasing a server is simple and relatively inexpensive. In fact, there are some free servers. I put air quotes over the free because there's always a catch. Usually free servers are paid for through ads that surround and crowd out your web pages. In addition, the free servers' pages are so cluttered with advertisements and backlinks that they overload the web pages and make it very difficult for them to load in a prompt manner. As you can tell, I'm not a big fan of free servers. There are some decent low-cost servers. HostGator will host one website for $2.75 per month when you pay a year at a time. iPage.com offers a comparable hosting package for $1.99 per month with an annual contract. You can expect your bill to jump up to about $9 per month for the first year. Hosting packages that are a bit faster and more robust include Bluehost.com and SiteGround.com. Both companies offer a beginning package under $9 a month. DreamHost offers a good entry-level server at $2.59 a month when you pay for it for 3 years. That price remains the same every year you renew after that. Now, if you want to add some email addresses to that server account on DreamHost, you'll have to pay an additional $2 per month. If you can afford the expense and have a larger ministry, I would recommend the middle tier option, Bluehost or SiteGround. You would spend about $11 to $17 per month for that middle ground server space. So you can expect to spend as little as $40 per year for a server and as much as $204 per year for a server. On a thin budget, I know it's expensive, but it is most likely the least expensive investment per connection that your congregation can make to reach non-church people. That is, more people will see your church through the website than any other means other than just driving by the church building itself. Now, you'll notice that most of the companies offer a free domain name with the server. You might be tempted to save the money and take them up on the offer. From a financial perspective, it would be wise. Just know that should you find that you don't like their hosting service, you'll have a difficult time transferring your domain name and your website to another company. There are restrictions on when domain names can be transferred, and getting access to the old site once the transfer is complete may not be possible. The third step, redirect the name servers. This step is the most technical, but really it's the simplest of all the steps. The best way to think about the World Wide Web is to use the world we live in as an analogy. In order to visit your friend in his home, you need the address. The address includes the house number, the street, the city, the state. We cannot find our friend's house without all the other information. A website contains a similar address, which is hidden from the user. The address behind the domain name is a set of numbers called an IP address. IP stands for Internet Protocol. An IP address looks something like this: 198.162.1.1. Without getting into the technical specifications, the numbers identify the location of the name server, which knows how to find the root directory to your website. In order for the name server to be able to point the user to the correct location, the name server pointer attached to the domain needs to be updated with the server's name server address. This connection is accomplished on the domain host from whom you leased your domain. Each site is a bit different, but the procedures are generally the same. First, copy the name server information to your clipboard. You'll find the name server information for your server on your server account. Usually there are two names. They will look something like this: ns1.bluehost.com and ns2.bluehost.com. NS stands for name server, and there's a one name server and a two name server. You have to have a backup redundancy for name servers. Then log into the domain registration website, which is hosting your domain. Select the domain and choose the option to set name server, or the option might say choose custom name servers. The terminology is slightly different for each registrar. In the window that opens, you will be given the opportunity to enter the name servers you copied from your server account. Select the Enter button or the Set Name Server button, and you're done. It can take up to 24 hours for the new DNS change to move through the system. Remember, domain name locator is not found in one place, but in many places, and it takes a lot of time for all those places to communicate with each other. Having said that, don't be surprised if the changes are complete within minutes. The fourth step is gathering the content for your website. The content includes the text for your articles, images, forms, and video content. I'll spend more time going through the content in the next podcast. For now, I want you to think about the content needs from the first-time visitor's perspective. You'll want to have a short one-paragraph greeting, a short one- to two-paragraph description of the church, the times of the service, the address of the worship location, and a way to contact the church for more information. If you'd like samples of the greeting and description, send me an email and I'll send them to you. When you write content for the web, you want it to be short but personal. Our culture has been shaped to frame life as a story. A story establishes the characters, the background, and presents a challenge, a quest, or a problem to be solved. It provides a map for the first step in the adventure. While you don't want to be literal in that metaphor, you want to establish a connection between your ministry and the guest. You want to challenge them. You want to point them in the direction of their next step. You accomplish those three processes through text and images on your website. I want to offer a few words about images on the website. Images should hint at a story that invites investigation. What I mean is that the images should be compelling. Compelling images show the faces of people as they interact. They utilize the rule of thirds. Good photographers who are not taking a portrait mentally divide their shots into two evenly spaced horizontal and vertical spaces. They line up their subjects so that key points fall on one of the one-third intersections. If you search for photography and rule of thirds, you will find some very helpful video tutorials. By all means, avoid the long-distance shots of a mob of people staged for the picture. Candid images of those who don't look staged are the best, and avoid excessive use of filters. The fifth step, having gathered the content, it's time to get onto your website. Back about the time God created dirt and the World Wide Web was just a puppy, people coded web pages in hypertext markup language, or HTML. The web pages were easy to create, but hard to make look good, and were not responsive. That is, they didn't adapt to the user and the screen size. With a proliferation of browsers and a higher expectation of users, it is not possible to hard code a proper web page in HTML. But that is actually a great thing. Developers have built content management systems, or CMSs, so that the website owner can focus on content and not have to focus on coding pages. As with the content, the process of using a CMS is too large to include in this podcast, but I do want to end this section on this. First, most congregations will not need to do much to keep their website updated if their only audience is the potential first-time guest. You won't need to spend hours each week tweaking your web page. Second, the newer systems are manageable and easy to use. Third, the CMS makes your website look great and function like a modern website should. Fourth, a good CMS automatically adjusts the website to a mobile platform. Most people surf the web using their phones. A good CMS makes the content look good and work well from the tiny screen on a phone to the large display of a desktop unit. You don't have to do anything to make it work. The CMS does it for you. Finally, this might seem a bit overwhelming to most people. However, the process is not difficult once you dig in. To minimize the workload on the pastor, I'd encourage your congregation to recruit 2 or 3 people to form the beginnings of a communication team. Ideally, a communications team would have a person that enjoys and is good at writing, a person who will take good pictures and has an eye toward design, and a technology person who's comfortable with web systems. The technology person doesn't need to know how to code HTML, CSS, or JavaScript. They should be comfortable with the basic operation of a computer and be able to grasp the abstract concept of templating content. Once the communication team has been identified, have them look at several church websites and critique them. My previous podcast can provide the tools needed to complete an informed evaluation. The Michigan District has a few sample websites that have been designed for simplicity and focus. While they're still in development mode, you can see them on my private server, the 20.org/church1, the 20.org/church2, and the 20.org/church3. You may wish to have the team check them out. In fact, we would be glad to install the sample site template and content on your server so that all you need to do is make adjustments to the content as you see fit. Once the team has determined what content it needs to gather or generate, it can set about completing the task. Again, the district has a worksheet that can be used to write the content needed for a sample site and guidelines for images that you may need. Finally, have your technology person stay tuned for a series of training webinars that will be posted online in January. The webinars will train people to use WordPress to create and maintain a website for a congregation. Before we go, I want to extend an offer for a limited number of ministries in the Michigan District. If your ministry is in need of a website makeover, the Michigan District is taking applications for candidates to help us beta test an upcoming website development initiative. If you'd like more information or would like to be considered in the beta test group, contact me for an application. Your ministry will be responsible for buying the domain name. The district, with the support of the Church Extension Fund, will cover all the other costs associated with your website. We want to explore new ways of helping congregations connect to potential visitors in their communities through an engaging website. I'm Todd Jones with the Michigan District Thought Leaders Podcast. You can reach me at todd.jones@michigandistrict.org. Have a great day in the Lord.